Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Charles Townes. Charles Townes won the Nobel Prize for his role in the invention of the maser and the laser. He is currently professor in the Graduate School at the University of California at Berkeley. He is also recently the author of a book, How the Laser Happened, Adventures of a Scientist. Professor Townes, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
Well, I grew up in South Carolina, in the somewhat mountainous region of South Carolina. And I grew up on a little farm. My father was a lawyer, but many Southerners like farming, and we had a farm just outside the city. And it was a great experience. I had good fun there. I picked cotton, and I milked cows, and that was chores which we boys were supposed to do. And I roamed around and saw animals and plants and butterflies and looked at the sky and had a good time.
And you like to fix things, too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I think growing up on a farm, you have to fix things. But anyhow, I like to know how things worked. I like to figure things out and see how they worked and try to make them work. And so I made all kinds of things, little wagons and slingshots and so on, and tried to make them better and bigger and so on.
And there's even a letter in your book that you wrote, I think, to your sister or someone with your request for birthday presents for 10 years old. And a lot of the list included things for this vocation of fixing and repairing and so on.
Yes, I guess I told her, well, if you're going to give me a good Christmas present, you've got to buy out a hardware store, because I want some screwdrivers and some pliers and drills and so on. But I was making things, and my brother also liked to make things, and we were kind of rivals. We would see who could make the best thing or invent something, or how to build it better.
And at one time, your father even invented a patent system between you and your brother to keep you from being at each other. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, my brother was a couple of years older than I, and I learned a lot from him, and we were always competing and so on. I was trying to keep up with him, and we would try to invent things, and I guess he felt I copied him, and I probably claimed that he copied me some. But my father said, well, we'll have a patent, so whoever does something first or shows how to do it first, the other person can't copy. So we had to pay my father 5 cents. Which was a lot of money for a little boy.
That's right.
5 cents for him to say, well, now this is a patent, and this is your rights versus somebody else's rights.
Looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your character?
Well, my parents were interested in the outdoors, and they were interested in natural history, plants and flowers and animals and so on. And my father would take us around out into the streams, and we would wade in the streams and the marshes and collect turtles and so on. He was interested. I think he probably would have been a scientist if he'd come along at a different age, but he was a lawyer instead. And my mother was very tolerant. We brought a lot of caterpillars, for example, into the house and fed them on leaves in the house, hoping they would make butterflies, which they did, but they would also crawl around the house. So you can imagine, my mother had to be pretty tolerant
of it.
And they encouraged us to find out things, to learn things and find out things and tinker with things. My father brought us some old clocks, for example, so we could take them apart and see how they worked, put them back together, so on. So they were very encouraging.
And you did reading when you were young? I mean, a family where books were important?
Oh, yes. Well, my father particularly had lots of encyclopedias, so we could we could settle a question, almost, decide who was right or what the real situation. We'd look it up, and he had several sets of encyclopedias, and we read a good deal. And I liked to read, but I primarily read about animals and about doing things and things of that type.
How did you get interested in science, or did it just flow naturally?
Well, I like to understand things. See, how do things work? What's this universe? The universe is so marvelous, you know. You go look at the stars. Now, why are they there, and what are they, and how do they work, and so on? And how do things grow? And how does machinery work? All of these, it's solving puzzles, and I like that. And I thought, well, I like animals and insects and so on. I thought maybe I might be a biologist, but when I took my first course in physics, I said, oh, physics, that really figures things out thoroughly, tells you exactly what's likely to be right and so on. And that was very pleasing to say, well, you can really decide what's right and what isn't right.
And was this course in high school that you first
finished? This was a course in college.
In college.
I took mathematics in high school, which I liked too, but there wasn't any physics much in high school, and so I learned mostly from my friends and myself. I learned science for a while besides mathematics, but then when I got into college, I took my first physics course, and almost immediately I said, oh, that's what I want. I like mathematics, but mathematics doesn't deal with the world exactly. You know, with physics, you're dealing with things and exactly how they work, and you can figure things out and find out new things and make new things work.
I really get a sense that your background, your parents' influence gave you a sense of awe and respect for the physical world and nature, but also a real will to understand it.
Yes, that's quite right. And my parents encouraged us to be willing to be different and so on, to do things we wanted to do. They were religiously oriented, and they had an admiration for the world and all of the world, but also a considerable interest in understanding of it, and they encouraged us.
And as you went to college and began working in labs, your capacity to fix things really paid off, didn't it?
Yes, that's quite right. I think if you play around with things and fixing things and so on, and we used to sometimes work on automobiles and little radios or whatnot, anything, that allows you to fix things and to innovate. You find if you don't have exactly the right tools, you don't have exactly the right batteries or something, you can think about, well, now how can I do this otherwise and fix it? And that's necessary in the laboratory. When you're doing research, you're doing things probably nobody's ever done before. So you're inventing things, new ways of doing things, and ways of doing things with what you have.
Were there any mentors in your schooling that stand out, any teachers, whether in college or wherever, who affected you not only in terms of what they were teaching, but as human beings?
Well, most of my teachers were wonderful people, and but I guess I was most impressed with the mathematics teachers. There were a couple of mathematics teachers I had that I liked very much, but I liked languages also, and I had some good language teachers. We had very high quality teachers, and I appreciated them. In college, they were very fine people teaching. They weren't doing very much research, but they were excellent people, intelligent and considerate and so on, and encouraged us to learn and thought things through carefully and thorough. So they were good teachers.
And your undergraduate work was at Furman College, and then you did your PhD work at Caltech.
Yes, my undergraduate work, actually it was Furman University it was called, but it did not really have graduate work at that time, Furman University. It was a small college, which was very good because I could interact with all the professors and all the people. Then my final PhD work was out at Caltech in California.
And that was a very exciting time in physics, was it not?
Well, it certainly was. It certainly was. This was the 1930s. Quantum mechanics, nuclear physics, and so on were growing. Nuclear physics had just been sort of discovered and so on. But we've had an exciting century in physics, I would say. Lots of different things have come up. That was an exciting time in physics, and I was at Caltech. One of my professors was Oppenheimer, who became famous, and Millikan, and we had a lot of good people there, and it was an intimate relationship because there weren't many students there, too.
And with your PhD in hand, and you got your degree in 39, you really wanted to go to a university to teach, but you chose not to. Tell us about that.
Well, because I finished in 1939, jobs were very scarce. This was a depression. Jobs were very scarce, and I wanted to teach in the university and do research and find out new things. I didn't want to go into industry and just make things and help people manufacture things. But there weren't many jobs, and Bell Laboratories person interviewed me and offered me a job. And my professor said, look, jobs are very scarce. I had thought maybe I would go as a postdoc and try for another year looking for jobs. Jobs are very scarce. Bell Laboratories is a good place, which it was. Bell Laboratories had a lot of good science. You should take it. So, all right, somewhat reluctantly, I went to Bell Laboratories, which turned out to be a very good thing. I learned a lot from it. You learn wherever you go, if the thing's happening, you're going to learn.
and you worked actually on radar bombing systems. Tell us a little about that.
I went to Bell Laboratories. They were to allow me to do basic physics. And I worked on how electrons come out of surfaces of material and so on for a while. Then, all of a sudden, the big boss at Bell Labs called me in his office and said, now, on Monday, you are to start working on radar systems for navigation and bombing. Oh, my dear. I had to become an engineer and a systems engineer and do this. Well, it wasn't what I wanted, but the war was coming on. Many people were getting into this, and during the war, most scientists did work on military things to try to help and help us win the war. So I felt, well, okay, I guess I have to do that. So I did that. And again, it was a great success in the sense that I learned a lot. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot. You can learn from all kinds of situations, and I learned a lot of new things which many physicists didn't know. I learned about electronics. I learned about microwaves and so on. And those have been the origins of much of my subsequent work. Whatever you do now is going to come out of what you've learned in the past. So it has.
And you went on to become one of the discoverers of the maser and then the laser. How did you wind up in that field? Just following through on what had interested you in your work at the Bell Labs?
Well, this is typical of new science. You follow a path. It's a path nobody else has followed. You're an explorer. It's really science is exploring. You look for new things and you look at new things and you never know just what you're going to find. I could guess, and I explained to Bell Laboratories that they should let me work on the interaction of microwaves and molecules, because microwaves were important to communication, and I felt the molecules could affect the microwaves in ways which could be useful. So they allowed me to do that, and that became a very interesting aspect of science, microwave spectroscopy. I wrote a book on it, and we learned a lot about molecules and nuclei and so on from that. But I wanted to get to shorter wavelengths. Now, microwaves had wavelengths anywhere from maybe this long to this long, and we were working then at wavelengths of about half an inch. I wanted to get to shorter wavelengths because the effects got more and more strong, more and more marked and interesting as we got to shorter wavelengths. Nobody could make the short wavelengths. So I worked and worked trying to get short wavelengths. By then, I also had gone to a university. I did get a job in the university after doing microwave spectroscopy at Bell Labs. There were more jobs after the war, for one thing. Furthermore, I developed a little bit of a reputation and knowledge about some special things, so I got a job at Columbia University. And I worked very hard there on microwave spectroscopy, but trying to get shorter waves. And I tried several different things which sort of worked, but they didn't work very well. I kept thinking about it for several years. And the Navy knew I was thinking about it. They asked me to head a committee, a national committee, to try to investigate how to get shorter waves. And we traveled all over and visited labs and so on. Just wasn't getting anywhere. So it was tough, but I felt very important, and I kept working at it. And then the maser came about, really. It was what was to be the last meeting of our committee. Our committee said we weren't getting anywhere. And we were meeting in Washington. And I woke up early in the morning worrying about it. And it was a nice morning, so I got up and I went out in the park and sat down on the park bench by the azaleas in a beautiful morning and thinking, now why haven't we been able to do this? And I thought out all the things we tried, trying to make very small little electronic amplifiers and so on, and nothing could be made quite that small and still have power in it and so on. I thought about other things I had tried and they didn't work, and I thought about using molecules. So now molecules oscillate very fast and they produce this radiation. After all, atoms produce light, very short wavelengths. We ought to be able to use those, but I'd thought about this before, and there was a law of physics called the second law of thermodynamics. It says, well, no, to get radiation from something, you have to heat it up. You have to heat it hotter and hotter to get more and more radiation. And it was clear that if you heat it hot enough to get very much radiation of this type, the molecules will just fly apart. So the second law of thermodynamics says, well, no, you can't get more than a certain amount. And, you know, the second law of thermodynamics. And now, wait a minute. Second law of thermodynamics, that doesn't have to apply. That assumes everything is like a warm temperature. But if you don't have things that are just heated, you pick out things with special energy and so on, the law doesn't have to apply. Wait a minute now. And I suddenly saw, well, we can pick out molecules with a lot of energy and use these selected molecules then, send them into a cavity where the rays would bounce back and forth and take the energy out of the molecules. Now, fortunately, I had known something about beams of molecules, as that was being worked on at Columbia, and I had just been in contact with all the right things, with the engineering and the resonant cavities and so on. So I took out a piece of paper and just scratched it out. Now, let me see, will this work? I put down the numbers. Can we get enough molecules? Yeah, it looks like it'll work. And I was just absolutely elated, of course. It was just, hey, this looks like it might work, you know. Well, I couldn't be sure. I thought, well, it'd be hard, but I think it might work. And so I went back to my hotel room, and Art Shallow, a friend of mine who became my brother-in-law, he'd been working with me. I told him about it, and he said, well, yeah, okay, well, maybe. So that's how the idea started, the whole thing.
And this coming together of the ideas for the maser in turn led to the development of the laser.
That led to the laser. It was basically the same idea, that we get energy from molecules and atoms by picking out certain ones that have excess energy, and then letting the waves interact with them and take the energy out of them, and that amplifies the waves and makes them grow bigger. The laser is exactly the same idea. I wanted to get down to wavelengths about a millimeter, a hundredth of an inch, or something like that. Now, those are pretty long light waves. Light waves are more like 20 thousandths of an inch, or something like this. You see, they're much, much shorter. And so it was a long time before I thought we'd get there. I wasn't sure we could get there, but eventually, after working on the maser, we got that to work. I had a student who worked on it. He worked for about 2 years, and he finally got it working. And then everybody got excited, and there was lots of work on it, and developed. Nobody thought we'd get down to light waves. But I thought, gee, I really want to get to shorter waves and how to do that. So I sat down at my desk and thought about it and wrote down all the numbers and said, now, what can we get? And I said, well, now, hey, wait a minute. We can get down to light waves, I think. Yeah, and I worked it out. Yes, it looked like it. Nobody had imagined we could get to light waves, and suddenly I realized we could. And so it was the same process, but just pushing it further and further and on down to light waves. So now we can have X-ray lasers, infrared lasers, and masers. See, the word maser stands for microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. That is, the radiation stimulates the molecules, makes them give up their energy. So it's microwave amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, an acronym MASER. Laser is the same thing, light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. My students kept making up these things. For infrared, they said, oh, that's an eraser. Infrared amplification.
That's good.
And gamma rays, if you'd made gamma rays, that would be a geyser.
You in your book, when you talk about doing science, you pick up a metaphor or an image from your childhood, and you say, we explore, What path to explore is important, as well as what we notice along the path. And there are always unturned stones along even well-trod paths. Discovery awaits those who spot and take the trouble to turn those stones. In that case, one may see what no one has seen before. And some aspects of maser and laser discoveries, such as the remarkable pure frequencies produced or the enormous concentration of power and its effects, also fit this image. We had to undertake making masers and lasers before these phenomena were clearly seen.
Well, that's quite right, and that is the nature of science. You explore new paths. And also, the paths that have been explored are frequently things that people have neglected and forgotten about. And you look in a new corner, turn over a new stone or something, you see something. And the maser really fits that because light was an old field when the laser came along. It was an old field. People thought they understood light. It had been worked on for many years. Even when I was a student in the 1930s, light was considered to be understood. And everybody knew about light, and there wasn't anything much new to come out of it. It was useful, and we used it all the time, but nothing much new was there. On the other hand, once the maser and the laser came along, we were using ideas which at least a few people had known about, but had never recognized how to put it together and how to make it useful. And that's how I say you're turning over a stone, you see the right thing, and then you go on from there. And so the laser completely changed the field of optics. And then the field of optics became an exciting new field again, lots of new discoveries, and we still are discovering really wonderful new things in the field of optics now.
Help us understand more about doing science, because many young people might not have the fortunate background in this rural setting that you have. But in your book and in your description now, you're conveying to us a sense of the discovery. But help us understand what it takes to be a scientist. Now, one thing that you talk about again and again in your book is that often you turn failure into opportunity. That, for example, not getting the first teaching position as you went into the job market, but rather going into an industrial lab, which wasn't something that you chose. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, a lot of times as you were thinking about new ways to do figures, you were discouraged by some of your mentors in the sense they were concerned that you were going down a road that wouldn't lead you anywhere.
Yeah, yes. Well, science is unpredictable, really. New discoveries are new. We don't know them yet. New things.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at what's happened during this century, all the big changes have been sort of sudden and unexpected. Nobody expected the nucleus to give out much energy, for example. And I know many people who argued against semiconductors for computers and so on. And in the early, just before this century, there were people saying, oh, well, anything heavier than air can't possibly fly. A balloon, maybe, but you'll put some light gas in it, but you can't expect anything heavy in air. Well, then along came the Wright brothers, and there it was, and now an airplane became obvious. And so it was with the laser and the many things that have happened in science, and new things we don't yet envisage. Once we envisage them clearly, why then we may develop them. Now, a scientist, I think first place a scientist has to try to understand things and understand a lot. Science is puzzle solving, but it's understanding also what puzzles other people have solved. Mm-hmm. We need to accumulate the information that other people have produced. A scientist produces new information, which is then property of everybody else. So you learn that, and then you think about, well, now, things we don't understand, and try to solve that puzzle. In addition, you want to talk with other people and argue with them. If you disagree with them, okay, then maybe that's good. If they think you're wrong, that may be good because it'll make you think, and you should examine yourself carefully. Don't be too egotistical. Examine yourself carefully. But if you think you're right, you stick to it. And that's happened many times with me. In the case of the maser, for example, We were trying to build it at Columbia University, and Jim Gordon, a student of mine, was doing his thesis on it. He'd worked at it for a couple of years, and two of the top professors in the department, I was a young professor then, the head of the department and the former head of the department, who was a Nobel laureate, they came into my office and said, look, that's not going to work. You know it's not going to work. We know it's not going to work. You're wasting the university's money, and you really ought to stop. Well, I told them simply, no, I've looked at it carefully. I think it has a reasonable chance. Mm-hmm. Well, they walked out kind of angrily, and they couldn't stop me. And so it kept going, and about 3 months it was working. Now, it was important that I had thought about it. It's important for them to question me, because that made me check it all over again. And when we got it working, they were friendly enough. One of them came around and told me, well, I guess I should realize you know more about what you're doing than I do. Mm-hmm. So on. Now, many times that happens to scientists. People will disagree with you. Very eminent scientists may disagree with you. But it may be just over those things that are new that people haven't realized yet, mm-hmm. and that they have to be waked up. We all get set in our ideas if we're not careful. So you have to be independent enough. You have to listen to other people, but be independent. You have to be curious, think about things, and explore things, and have good fun finding out something's new.
And as part of this, you have to persevere, right? You have to sort of keep. You are a navigator explorer, basically.
Yes.
You have to keep at it, listen to the criticism, but if necessary, change your course.
Yes, that's right. And the criticism may be right, and you want to think about that carefully. And if so, if you're going off this direction, you said, well, no, you better bear that direction and so on. You think of the explorers of the American continent that came out. They didn't know what to expect, many of them. And they would hit a dry desert they would have to walk through for days with no water, and high mountains and so on. They didn't know what was beyond, but they had some confidence they'd find something. And eventually, of course, they found a lot of wonderful things out west. And science is very similar. It is exploration. And we have to be persistent, and we're going to fail sometimes. You just accept that. You fail, actually. If you investigate something that might be true and you find clearly it's not true, that's a discovery too. Mm-hmm. Because you've understood it. You've understood now, no, that isn't the case. And you've understood something that other people probably haven't understood before. So a failure in that sense is still good science. Maybe more exciting to feel you're successful, but a failure in that sense, when you really understand something better, that's good science.
And in your particular case, the part of your contribution was to show the significance of the concepts and the ideas that you had been working with in the industrial lab and give it a new importance by redefining what it meant for what could be done. Is that fair?
Yes, yeah, I think so. I would say another aspect like that I would emphasize is my experience in an industrial laboratory and with engineers was a very important part of my recognition of what might be done, because physicists didn't have much to do with amplifiers and oscillators, mm-hmm. and so on. Engineers did. Engineers didn't know quantum mechanics and atoms and molecules. The physicists knew atoms and molecules and quantum mechanics, but they had a kind of a set mind about what could be done and what couldn't be done. And they didn't understand oscillators and amplifiers too well. They weren't terribly interested. And by it really, the field grew out of a marriage of physics and engineering, a marriage of quantum mechanics and electrical engineering, you might say, a marriage of light and electronics, the lasers. And many people, when the laser came along, they said, oh, that's a very cute idea, that's nice, but it's a solution looking for a problem. What can it do? What's it going to solve for us? It's so new, they hadn't thought about what it could do. From my viewpoint, I said, well, look, it marries optics and electronics. Both of those are very important. You marry those two fields, there are going to be lots of applications, and I could see some applications. I couldn't possibly see all of them. You can't ever. Science keeps developing.
And it was really your curiosity, your quest for understanding, and not really your sense of what finally would come out of all of these discoveries.
No, it wasn't my curiosity. The reason I was trying to get short waves was to do science, mm-hmm. find out more about molecules. I wasn't looking for an application. I wasn't thinking of a laser beam that would be a bright light or something. I wanted to find out more about molecules, and I wanted to get shorter waves to study the molecules. Just basic work, not applied at all. But now, look what's come out of it, all kinds of applications. Mm-hmm. And you should think about what would a research director or a political person who wants to donate some gifts, give some state money to have the right thing developed, would they say, well, now, I want a very bright light, so I'm going to give some money to somebody to study interaction of microwaves and molecules. No, it's completely out of the field. Or it's a very, very important surgical tool, for the eyes especially. Mm-hmm. But in many other ways, it's a very important medical tool. What doctor would say, well, I knew you need a new surgical instrument, so I'm going to get somebody to study molecules and interaction with microwaves. They wouldn't possibly do that. And yet, it's clear it grew out of that field. In fact, there were three different people who more or less had this idea. Myself, and then there's Joe Weber at Maryland, and then there were a couple of Russians, Basov and Prokhorov, in Moscow.
This is the idea for the Maser laser.
The idea for the Maser, that's right. The basic idea for the laser, too. The three different people that sort of had the idea. Mm-hmm. And all three of those worked in this field of microwaves and molecules. Mm-hmm. So it's clear it had to come out of that field, the right ideas coming together. And it's very important that we may think we know a lot, and we do, but when we know a lot, we also get sort of fixed in our ideas. We go down a given track. Mm-hmm. So we don't look off in the corner somewhere and suddenly find a whole new batch of things. And it's like when the Maser came along and the laser was sort of like opening a door. I didn't even know the door was there, and going to a room, a fantastic room, that never dreamed might be there at all, you know. Mm-hmm. You get this little trail in the right direction, and you lead into all this wonderful stuff. And unpredictable, I don't know, but it's fun doing the exploring.
You say at one point, I've tried to devote my energies to opening new fields with the intention of moving on to other things as soon as they start to become well established. I like to turn over new stones to see what is under them. It is the most fun for me to be on the fringes, exploring aspects that seem interesting to me but have not attracted the attention of others. Once a field is opened up and is successful, and once others are flocking to it, I feel my own efforts in it are no longer critical. At about that point, I like to move on to something I think may be promising but overlooked.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's more fun. Let's take the laser, for example. As soon as it really broke through and we had them, and then all kinds of people started working on it, industry and so on, and lots of people working on it. Well, it's an interesting field, and I worked at it for a few more years, but then I decided, well, no, there are plenty of people working on this. There are other things to be discovered that being neglected, and so I went on to other things. And I characteristically have done that. I change fields about every 10 to 15 years or something like that. The field develops, lots of people in it, it's going strong. Well, then I'd rather go off and look for something new.
Tell us a little about this. Let's go back now that we have a better understanding to that moment in the park, that moment of discovery that in some way many things followed from. What were your feelings at that moment as somebody who's just interested in understanding? I mean, convey to us your surprise at what you saw, but the sense of wonder, I guess, right?
There's a sense of wonder. It's like a sudden revelation, an inspiration, a sudden revelation. And on the one hand, it seemed almost too good to be true. I wasn't sure it would. I thought thought the principal said it would work. I wasn't sure whether we could really make one work, getting the right things together and so on, but I thought probably so. And there were questions, but as well as a great excitement that, hey, this looks like a way of doing it. Now, particularly later, one might say, well, I've certainly said to myself, why in the world wasn't this discovered before? Well, there was no one idea that somebody didn't know. It was just a question of putting it all together and seeing what its importance was. And yes, that was the point, because the idea is it could have been discovered 20 years earlier. But even after I had the idea, many people thought, well, okay, it's kind of an interesting idea, but, you know, where is it going? It isn't going to do anything. And a lot of people came into my laboratory and saw we were trying to build this maser. They said, oh, yes, well, nice idea. But nobody ever tried to build one. Nobody else tried to build one. They didn't compete with us. They didn't think it was worthwhile, you see, worth the effort. But I thought I saw some possibilities there. And so then when we got it going and showed what those possibilities were, very pure frequencies, very sensitive amplifiers, and so on, then everybody got excited, and lots of people jumped into the field, and that was a very busy field. Same thing is true of the laser. Because the maser had been so successful, when I had the idea of the laser, as soon as I published it and made it public, then everybody got excited. They didn't have to wait till I built one. The result was somebody else built one first. Ted Maimon built the first laser, actually. Mm-hmm. Everybody jumped in the field trying to race to build one. And all the first lasers were then built in industry. The ideas came from academic fields. But a lot of the people who trained in those fields had gone into industry, and once industry saw it was useful, then they did a very good job. They could concentrate on it, and many of these things are built and done and further developed by industry now.
Throughout your career, I think you, as a responsible citizen, have worked with the government, and we'll talk about some of those experiences in a second, but in a sense, you, from that experience, you came to see the limits of government in defining the science agenda. Tell us a little about that. I know one incident that I read this morning was in the late 50s. You were on a commission, I believe, or a panel, and really, I believe it was the Air Force really produced a document with scientific advice where really there was no mention of space, and this was before Sputnik and so on. So what are the limits there and the possibilities, and then what is the responsibility of the scientist in that regard?
Well, I think so far as limits are concerned, I think we all have to be a little modest about our own limitations. Everybody is limited. I'm sure there are things, interesting things around I haven't imagined and you haven't imagined and so on. We miss things. Everybody does. We have to keep helping each other and we have to keep exploring and so on. The Air Force wanted us to study what would be the possible technologies of the next 25 years that they should be working on. Well, they got together a group of scientists and engineers and they had a lot of good ideas. At that time, however, rockets were around, but they hadn't been very successful yet. But we talked about possibly going into space and space work. And the Air Force said, oh, please don't say anything about that, because Congress will think we're just playing around. Now, this is purely political, you see, that, well, please don't say anything about that, because Congress will kill us, because they think they're just playing around talking about space and so on. We're supposed to be doing making military efforts. And so don't put that in your report, please. So we didn't. And that was the summer of 57. In the fall of 57, Sputnik went up. Then suddenly Congress changed completely. Everybody said, we must get into this. And so the whole report was rewritten and published the next year with lots of space in it.
What then does the scientist do? I mean, if he's a citizen of a country, he wants to offer his services to this government. Yes. as a responsible citizen.
Well, I think I think scientific advice is very important to government, and politicians realize that. Politicians recognize that there are certain scientific things they really don't understand. They have to call on scientists. I think in most other fields, such as how people behave, they probably think they understand it. They may or may not, but they think they understand it. Whereas in science, they recognize there are things they don't understand. So they do call on scientists, and scientists have an opportunity then to advise government. Now, in my view, it's very important that scientists advise government without having a stake in the government or a stake in industry that may make the things they're advising on. And this means that academic scientists, I think, are important, because they can go in and they can give the government advice. The government doesn't like it, they can come back home, they still have a job, and they don't have to worry exactly about whether the government takes advice. And this means it can be more objective and not adhere so much to these political pressures, you see. Now, that kind of advice has been very important. Eisenhower first formed a very good committee to personally advise the president, and he listened carefully to them, and it had a very important role there. I think scientists are still advising the government extensively, but they don't have quite as critical role as they did during that time when everything was changing rapidly. But they must be there, and I think we scientists have a duty not only to talk to the public and try to help the public understand, but also, when asked at least, to try to give advice in Washington, serve on committees, study things, and make reports about what seems to be best and what seems to be workable and not workable. Our National Academy of Sciences does that, and there are other groups. At the time I first started, there weren't so many people doing it, and this is one reason I agreed particularly to do it. I gave up 2 years of my research work to go to Washington to do it because I felt there weren't enough people there.
Now, another place where scientists makes a difference is science is a global phenomenon. You have already talked about how you would learn from scientists not only in this country but all over the world about progress in the developments that led to the Maser. During the Cold War, meetings like Pugwash and the conversations that were going on between American and scientists were really critical, actually, in contributing to our understanding of how we could draw the limits to the relationships between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And on one occasion, you actually were involved in discussions on banning weapons in space. Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, I think it's quite true that scientists are important in international relations. Science is a social affair in the sense that everybody interacts, and it's a universal thing. If you discover the right science, it applies to everybody. And applies to everybody, and people like to try to understand and learn from each other. If somebody over here has discovered something, it's important for you to know that and what it is. And scientists can talk to each other then and trade ideas in a friendly way on scientific problems. And this means they're rather internationally minded. Now, in the case of the Soviet Union and of China, any countries which are cut off, those countries recognize that they must keep up with science. So they're eager for their scientists to be in contact with scientists in other countries, and vice versa for that matter. So there have been international meetings of scientists, and scientists can talk with each other rather in a rather friendly way about things and be reasonably frank. And so a great deal of information was learned about the Soviet Union through discussions among scientists, and the Soviets learned a great deal about the United States through those discussions. In fact, I once went over and had a substantial conversation with Gorbachev when he was early in his power, went over with some politicians, and Gorbachev said, "Well, you know, most of what I understand from about the West comes from the intellectual community here. I have to learn from them." And by that he meant the scientist and the artist who went outside and could learn about other societies and so on. And he was very frank about it. Now, in addition, we could see that the scientists understood our points of view and what we were trying to do, and many of those scientists were advising the Soviet government on military things and other things. So that we could get together and talk in a friendly way and recognize what you have to do to maintain peace and prevent danger, too much danger. So that interaction, I feel, has been very important. Same thing is true in China. The Chinese are very eager to understand American scientists, science, and technology. And so there was an exchange. And I went over as part of an exchange on astronomy, but because it was astronomy, we went to observatories where most Westerners weren't allowed to go at all, and we could cruise around and try to understand the country. Now, I think not only that those countries which are more or less closed off learned a lot from us, but we learned a lot from them and were able to advise our government about, in this particular case of Pugwash meetings, that's a group that got together to try to talk about possible peace, and there's largely scientists and academic people. I was able to talk with a leader of the Soviet space program, and we talked about the possibility of banning any mass destructive weapons from spacecraft, from orbiting spacecraft, and he agreed it would be a good idea. And he had been a former general, too. And so he, I'm sure, took it back to his country. I took it back to our leaders. And in a couple of years, well, there was an agreement between the two countries to ban all weapons of mass destruction from satellites, which I think has been a good agreement. But this, the idea started there. Of course, it had to be carried through by politicians who it also understood and saw it.
Let's talk about the future now a little. How would you advise students who might see this tape or read it on the web about how they should prepare for a career in science?
Well, for one thing, I think it's important to have a rather broad education, get a broad basis in science, and also in the humanities, and understand things broadly. You see, if you're going to advise government, interact with other people, there are a lot of very basic human things you need to understand, too. So I think a broad education is a very important one. Even in research, it's important because you never know where your research is going to lead exactly. And you're knowing other things. My knowing a bit of engineering, for example, was so important. So a broad education is important. But then I think look at science. Look at the things that you think are most interesting to you, that you think are important and interesting to you and you have fun at. I've always said that you do your best at things you enjoy doing. Mm-hmm. And do the things that you like to do, that you think are interesting and important, and then delve into them deeply. But remember this requirement of a background, too, a wide background. And who knows what science is going to be important. When I started in the physics, nobody had ever heard of physics. I told my friends I was going to do physics. Oh, physics, I had to explain, well, it's a little bit like chemistry. They'd heard of chemistry. A little bit like electrical engineering, heard of that. Well, now everybody's heard of physics. But there are other fields they haven't heard so much about. We can think of many important fields, but I think for a student, you explore and find the things that you think are most interesting and you think are also important. That's what you'll have the most fun at and probably make the biggest contributions with.
Do you think our K-12 educational system is doing a good job of preparing students to be scientists?
I don't think our schools do as well at preparing for science as they should. One reason is that the teachers frequently don't know a lot of science. It's hard to get many scientific teachers with good scientific background. The teachers are even a little afraid of it, even. So that's one reason. I think also that science has been growing in importance, steadily growing in importance, and going to continue to grow in importance. So whereas in the old days we could sort of forget about science for a while in schools, now I think it's more important for everybody to know science. The ordinary citizen, even though not a scientist, ought to know enough science to help out in some of these judgmental things of what course should the nation take in science and technology. So it's important that we have much more science, and it's important we have good teachers. Now, how to get youngsters interested in science? I think a lot of it ought to be participatory. Mathematics is one thing you can participate in just with a paper and pencil and in class. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed mathematics partly for that reason while I was in school. But participation is an important part of it. Look at the stars and think about them. Go look through some telescopes. Think about animals, how they're made and how they behave and so on. Explore the fields around you and so on, the areas around you, the backyards around you. There are insects and all kinds of things. I think for people to look at the world and try to figure it out, and for teachers to encourage them and the parents to encourage them, I think that's part of the curiosity which is necessary in order to develop a strong interest in science.
I think I hear you, and correct me if I'm wrong, suggesting that maybe too much of an emphasis on facts,
yes,
on detail, is the wrong way to go, whereas
exactly,
stimulating the curiosity is what we want to do.
Exactly. It's understanding rather than facts that are important. Just know a lot of facts, you may not understand how things fit together. But understanding and curiosity and exploration and fitting things together, if once you fit things together, then the facts are more obvious. And you don't have to remember the facts. You just understand how things work.
Now, many of our leaders have identified K through 12 education as a problem area. How do you think scientists can contribute to changing the view of how science is taught and maybe intervening in the classroom to prepare the kids who will then come on to college where we're clearly doing better?
Well, I think for one thing, scientists who have some time, and this would include retired scientists, for example, retired engineers, I think they could be in contact with the schools and the teachers, at least. And we all can be in contact with the teachers and help the teachers. And the teachers, I think, welcome a real contact like that. Come and talk in the classes and so on. I think also things like Exploratorium here in San Francisco, things which people, youngsters, can go and participate in and try some scientific experiments and try things out and see things and watch things. Those are some importance, and scientists can help produce those and help bring them into class and so on. But I would believe a sort of a personal interaction with the teachers and students on the part of the sciences, make an effort for that personal interaction would be an important part of it.
I have one final question. You mentioned that religion was a part of your upbringing, and I'm curious as to how the awe that you find in doing science has stimulated or invigorated your the religious side of you.
Well, it is very, very interesting, and I think increasingly people are recognizing that kind of input. For example, our discovery of the Big Bang. The Big Bang was discovered by Arnold Penges, who was a student of mine and worked with me. And the discovery of that Big Bang, we know that the universe had a kind of a special occasion when it was unique. It was very, very small, and it suddenly exploded and expanded and produced what we are now. And we study how that happened and all the special things that had to happen and so on, and how it was constructed, the laws of physics were made and atoms were made in just such a way that all this could happen and we could finally be here. It's just amazing. And many scientists say, well, somehow there has to have been an intelligence that put all this, that made it work this way, that did the right thing, put the right things together. And it is impressive. And there's still much more to be found out. I'm sure we'll be amazed at as we learn it.
Professor Towns, thank you very much for taking this time to talk with us about your intellectual journey and the exciting exploration that is science. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.